Today is February 29th, the second hour at Milton, Wednesday at the JCC. We're learning Hasidic insights on the Parsha. This week's Parsha is Parsha Titzaveh, which is the second Parsha that talks about the building and construction of the Mishkan, the Tabernacle. Last week was Chuma, and that talked about the physical construction of the boards and the planks and the walls and the ceiling and of the vessels, the furniture inside. And this week talks about primarily the clothing, the vestments of the high priest, how to construct them, how to weave them, and then about the consecration ceremony to consecrate and inaugurate the priests and the tabernacle. And of course, as we expect, the Hasidic approach is going to have nothing to do with all of that. It's just a jumping off point. Before we begin today, I want to review for 5 or 10 minutes what we did last time, because today's material will be a continuation of last week. Last week, Parsha Chuma. So, we saw three different sources last week. One was called Kiddushat HaLevi. That was the one that was only in Hebrew, and I translated. It's by Rabbi Levi Yitzhak Mibertachev, and that is in the second generation of Hasidim, right after the first generation of the Baal Shem Tov and the founders. And what we saw in Rabbi Levi Yitzhak Mibertachev was a contrast between saying that God created in the past tense and God creates in the present tense. And he said that when we talk about God created in the past tense, God created the world, then we are basically looking at human beings as now have been created, the world was created, and we are in some sense independent and separate from God. Whereas when we talk about God creating, that is to say that God is constantly infusing energy and overflowing in the world and continually sustaining and creating the world, then when we talk in those terms, then human beings are not separate from God, we're part of an ongoing amalgam of existence that is not to be separated from God. Okay? And it seemed that he was saying that it's a higher level to imagine yourself as being constantly recreated by God, constantly part of this overflow of energy. In psychological terms, theological terms, the difference between these two approaches is, remember, the words transcendence as opposed to immanence. Transcendence means God is other and beyond and great, whereas immanence means God is part and everything is connected to God. To draw it on the board, I didn't draw these circles last time. The small circle is the world, the big circle is God. And I drew here two different theological models. This model is transcendence, and this model is immanence. In other words, in this model, the world's over here, God is over here, and they're separate. God created the world, and now the world stands, it's created, and we relate to God as something beyond. Whereas in this model, the world is inside of God. So everything in the world is also in God. And God's energy is constantly imbuing the world with its existence. Everything is within God. This is the model of immanence, this is the model of transcendence. And in psychological terms, we talked last week about psychological terms, this model is in which man relates to God with awe. In this model, man relates to God with love. What do I mean? In this model of transcendence, God is big, beyond, holy, transcendent, amazingly powerful other, and I, in the face of God, I just bend, bow, and accept. Whereas in this model, the immanent model, God is part of me. God is not something beyond that I have to show obedience and servitude to, but I'm part of God. It brings about love and joy and happiness and uprightness. the author, the Kedut Shatalevi, said it's an oscillation between the two, how I relate to God. Then we move to something everyone will remember. We move to the Beis Yaakov, the son of the Mei HaShiloach, right? The son of the Mei HaShiloach. This is the father, the son I didn't bring with me today. And he talked about the metaphorical or spiritual significance of the choreography of the Shemona Asrei. Remember? Baruch Atah Hashem. In which he said that Baruch Atah, which is to say bending and bowing, signifies this approach. That I bow to the God who's outside me. And I show servitude. And I am separate from God. God is one thing, I'm another thing. Whereas when I say after Baruch Atah Hashem and I stand up straight, that's when I no longer feel the need to show servitude to God, because I realize that God is not something outside me to be served. God is something inside me to be united with and to identify with and to be in love and joy, because it's part of me. It's not something outside of me. This approach is much more natural and flowing natural and flowing. Mm-hmm. Whereas this approach is more stilted, and it's fearful. It's an awe of the God who's outside of me.
I was thinking about this at Shul this past weekend. I was thinking to myself, you know, how quickly, of course, we do this and stand up. That it should only happen so fast that I could have be imbued with God like that, you know, to be feel like a servant and then all of a sudden feel, you know, God's presence within me. That if it could only happen so fast.
Well, what you just told fills me with joy, because if anyone remembers anything we talk about for more than 5 minutes after the class, that's success. That's what we want to be doing.
No, we live with it. No. We live with it.
I'm so aware of the bowing now.
Yes.
Really?
Oh,
you guys are much better than me. I forget 5 minutes after the class.
No.
And then I'm thinking of what I'm going to do, and I know I'm doing it wrong.
So if you think too much, you'll get stuck.
Yeah. Yes.
Rabbi, would you please correct her? There is no way you're doing it wrong.
Right.
Okay. You're right, Bruce.
It's how you feel. If you can just get some way I feel this way. If pulling my ear makes me feel good, it's okay.
So Bruce, I actually have to disagree with you.
Please,
because it's true that Hasidut here is a lot about the feelings in the inner world. But what distinguishes between Hasidut and Christianity, among other things, is that it's not only the feelings in the inner world; it's still founded upon the fundamental presupposition that there is a right and a wrong. There's a right way of doing things and a wrong way of doing things. There's commandments, there's a framework, right? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
So, sorry that I pounced upon you.
It happens all the time.
That, I will still love
that
you.
People pounce upon you or that I pounce upon you? I hope you mean people.
Oh, God.
Nobody.
That's an inside joke for those of us who've been married a long time.
So the third source we saw last time that connects to the first two sources, the third source was the Mei HaShiloach himself, the Izbitcher Rebbe. And he talked about last week's Parsha, the fact that the Torah says that the Jewish people should contribute gold and silver and crimson and royal blue to the building of the tabernacle, the building fund. And he said that giving all these things to the tabernacle doesn't mean giving all these things to the tabernacle. What it means is, it's a metaphor for giving all the gold and silver inside of you to God. A limsor, to hand over your talents and your inner world to God, and to let God take it over, to let God run it, to let God be in charge. And what that means is this. It means moving from this model to this model. That usually we think that the gold and silver inside of us, our talents, our ideas, we think that they're ours. Because we're here and God is here. We're independent. And we have to follow God's commands. But it's we, as independent people, have to decide to follow God's commands. Says the Meir Shiloach, that's good. But a higher level is to hand yourself over to God, which is to envision yourself not outside of God, but envision yourself handed over into God, which is this model. Move to the model of immanence. And then he said, what to me is among the most important things in this whole thing, he gave us the psychological insight that grows from the theology, which is that God doesn't want us to always be in fear of him, but wants love and joy. And again, those are secret words in a certain sense. Fear is this model, and love and joy is this model. Because as long as God is other than me, there's going to be an element of servitude and fear. Remember I talked about the idea of the Haredim last week? I think I talked about this, that the in the 20th and 21st century, the ultra-Orthodox call themselves Haredim, which means fearers of God. And in a certain sense, this Hasidic philosophy is a veiled polemic against that. That it's not good to be Haredi. But rather you have to become not Haredi, but you have to become Ohev, a lover of God, who feels united with God, that God is inside of you. You don't have to fulfill in an external sense his command. Rather, his commands are inside of you and you do them naturally. It flows and it becomes a matter of love and joy and identification and not just external obedience. And I talked about the fact, and with this we're finishing our review, talked about the fact that in many places the Meir Shiloach comes out against the religious personality that is paralyzed by his fear of God, who loses his creativity and his sense of life and power because of the fear of God. The Meir Shiloach wants us to gradually uplift the fear of God to become love and identification, because when you reach this understanding that you're part of God, you're no longer in fear of God, rather you feel empowered by God because what you do is part of God. And it leads to great self-confidence and creativity and a sense of independence. Paradoxically, you feel independent and powerful because you know you're not. Because you know that it's all part of God. Remember the paradox from last week? Mm-hmm. And all that I said right now with that review is to lead into what we're going to see today. You ready? Okay. So, it's Parshat Tetzaveh in the Meir Shiloach. We're going to see two different passages in the Meir Shiloach in which he says the same thing based on two different sets of verses in the same Parsha. In order to get the background, we're going to look at the verses, some verses in this week's Parsha that talk about the vestments of the high priest.
This is Exodus 30?
It's Exodus 28, 30-31.
Yeah, okay.
So we're going to read at the beginning of Parsha Tetzaveh, chapter 28, verse 2. And again, this is just a set of the background for what the Meir Shiloach will tell us. Verse 2 of chapter 28 of the book of Exodus. And thou shalt make holy garments for Aaron thy brother, for honor and for beauty. And then, after reading verse 2, let's read verse 4. And these are the garments which they shall make: a breastplate and an ephod, and a robe and a quilted undercoat, a mitre, is that how you say that in English?
And a sash.
And a girdle, and they shall make holy garments for Aaron thy brother. They might have a different translation, but the point for us is to count them. How many are there?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Right,
seven.
Six.
Is there six?
1, 2, 3.
Four,
two,
I get seven.
Oh, no. It's, okay, I see it's six because it's a fringed tunic, you...
There's only one.
There's only one, yeah. Okay.
Okay, so there's six different garments.
Okay.
The problem is, if you open up the Mishnah in the year 200 of the Common Era, the codification of Jewish law, you'll see there are eight garments. But the Torah only says six. We have a problem of two missing garments.
Where do you see eight?
Well, you see them in the Mishnah, 1,000 years later, but now we're going to see them later on in the Torah. So now let's go to, for example, verse 36. As you turn the pages, you see it talks about making all the six garments we just talked about. In verse 6 it says make the ephod, and verse 15 says make the breastplate. Then it goes on in verse 31, make the robe. And it tells you about making all of the six garments that we just set out in that opening list. And then in verse 36, it tells us to make a garment that did not appear in the original list. Verse 36, and thou shalt make a plate of pure gold, and engrave upon it, like the engraving of a signet, holiness to the Lord. And thou shalt put it on blue lace, and put it upon the mitre. How do you have that in English? Put it upon the hat?
Headdress.
Headdress, okay. Upon the forefront of the headdress it shall be. So what that means is that in addition to the six garments that we read about in the opening list, which was the breastplate and the ephod and the undergarment and all of those other things, and the sash and the hat or the headdress or the turban, however you call it, there's also to be a plate of gold on the forehead of the high priest that says on it, holy to God. And the question is, why isn't this seventh garment listed among the original six? Secondly, there's another garment that was missing in the first list, and that is pants. There's no pants there. And you have to read forward here in the book until you, in chapter 28, verse 42, till you finally read about the girdles or the breeches, and thou shalt make linen breeches. And the question is, why aren't the breeches, the pants, mentioned in the original list? That's our question for today, for the Me'ah Shiloach. Why, of the eight garments, including the plate on the forehead and the pants, why are six of them mentioned in the first list but not the other two? Why are the pants and the plate on the head missing from the first list? That's the question. Okay?
You want our answer?
No, I don't want your answer. I emphatically don't. Because the answer the Meshulach will give has nothing to do with anything you could have thought of. You ready? Here's the Meir Shiloach. On the sheet. And he opens with the verse from Shmot 28:4. We're going to read just snippets, not the whole thing. On the left-hand side, I put little tiny brackets to show us where we're going to read and where we won't read. We're reading within the brackets. The tzitz, the head plate, that's the gold plate on the forehead, hints that he is constantly cleaving to the blessed God, as he is commanded always to wear it on his forehead. Engraved on the tzitz were the words Kodesh Lashem, holy unto God, meaning that the words know the God of your father and serve him were constantly in the depth of his thought. Okay, that makes a certain degree of sense, that the plate on the forehead that says holy to God is on the forehead, right where his head is, to indicate that his head, his mind, is always cleaving to God and being holy to God. Fine. We're going to skip four lines to my next bracket. The robe, Me'il, teaches of his great fear of God. For it was made entirely of techelet, that's the color. It says here sky blue, I call it royal blue, which hints at fear. The matter is that the color blue, royal blue, which is what the Me'il, the robe, is made of, the blue is supposed to remind you of the heavens. The heavens supposed to remind you of God. and that means God is up in heaven, I'm fearful of God. Why were the pants and the tzitz not mentioned when the garments are enumerated in verse 4? Right, that's our question. The pants were not mentioned, and the reason he gives is not important for us. We'll skip the reason for the pants. I'm skipping three lines. The tzitz was not mentioned, as it was explained in the Zohar. The brilliance of God's desire is revealed at the mincha prayer of Shabbat. That's a mystical statement from the Book of Jewish Mysticism. And of course, we understand nothing of what has to do with anything at this point. We're just reading it, and we'll try to figure it out in another few minutes. The tzitz was given to Aaron HaKohen since he had great fear of God. For all the tribe of Levi possessed great fear of God. As it is written in Malachi, I gave him fear. And all the more so the high priest. Even his very name teaches a fear, for Aaron is the numerical equivalent of 256. You know Gematria? Every Hebrew letter has a value, and if you take the value of the letters of the name Aharon, it comes to 256. Corresponding to the 256, 2 to the 8th power, wings of the angels called Chayot HaKadoshim, and wings teach a fear. Without going into all the mystical stuff, we're talking about the vision of Ezekiel, in which Ezekiel saw the chariot of God, if you used to sing it in summer camp when you were kids, or something like that. And in that vision, he sees holy creatures, and he sees God, and he sees the fire and the chariot, and he sees that the holy creatures cover their faces with their wings. And that teaches us, why do they cover their faces? On fear of God. Their wings, what they used to cover their eyes, their faces, so the wings symbolizes fear of God. And the gematria of wings basically is the gematria of our own. So again, all the details don't matter. We're just trying to tell you that our own, the priest, is a symbol of fear of God. And that's why he was given the holy plate on his forehead. We didn't explain anything yet. You should be very confused still. So stay confused. But now we'll get to the point. Corresponding to this great fear that Aaron had of God, he was given the tzitz to vivify and delight his soul. For the tzitz teaches of the love that the blessed God has for Israel. Let me just stop for a second. And I'm going to go to the board. Aaron is symbolic of fear of God, which means this model. Remember? That's this model. And this says that tzitz, I'll read it again, that tzitz is to vivify and delight his soul. For the tzitz teaches the love that the blessed God has for Israel. Love is this model. So what it means is that Aaron is here and he's given the tzitz to wear on his forehead to bring him here.
The tzitz is not on his forehead, is it?
The tzitz is on his forehead. The tzitz is the gold plate that says holy to God that is on his forehead.
Or not tzitzit. That's
right, tzitzit is something else.
Yeah.
There's a relationship between them, but that's for a different class. And remember, it said at the beginning that tzitz symbolizes clinging to God, because it's like God penetrating your forehead, which again is this. So the idea again is that the tzitz is about bringing Aaron from model one to model two. Theologically and psychologically. From fear to love, from distance to unity. Okay? Then at the time when the blessed God reveals his great love, all the fears depart. In other words, when you move from a model of transcendence to immanence and you feel God within you, all fears depart. And when by fears, it means all fears of God, everything connected to the distance from God, the fear of God, the awe of God, the bowing down to God, that all leaves you. And Israel experiences great empowerment. Empowerment, right? When you feel God within you, self-confidence, empowerment, creativity, lifeblood, standing up straight and powerful for what you believe in. Not just in awe and fear of God, not just bent down, but standing up straight. Right? Everything now is coming together. Now I'm going to stop for a minute, and I'm going to remind everyone of the question we began with. The question we began with was, why did the original list of the clothing of the high priest have only 6 elements and not 8? In other words, why were the tzitzit and the pants not mentioned in the list at the beginning, but only later? As far as the pants go, we're ignoring that. He's focusing on the tzitzit. So to focus on the question, why is the tzitzit not mentioned in the original list, but only mentioned later? Yes?
The same, because we are going from the physical, just like bowing, and after that, raising to be part of it. So when you...
Let me say, right.
When you reach that part, when you did the physical area that we are in the transcendent part, you do more steps.
Right.
And at the end, you raise. You have already acquainted. You already are
right.
One, entrenched with God.
Right.
And that is holy unto God.
Right. Right.
Completely mm-hmm. submerged, mm-hmm. completely.
Right. So the idea is, as Alma just said, the idea is, why is the tzitzit not mentioned in the first list? The answer is because you cannot begin here.
Never.
That's the answer. You can't begin with this. Okay. You have to begin here and move here. There has to be a progression that the spiritual life of the Jew should indeed begin with fear of God, mm-hmm. should begin with transcendence, should begin the understanding that God is other, God is beyond, God is transcendent, God is far, and God demands obedience of a servant to his master. And only after you've established that will in your soul can you move to the next stage. First, Bruce?
Why could you not reach that state without having an ornament on your forehead?
Of course you can. This is just symbolic.
Oh, okay.
It's
okay.
Symbolic. We're not the high priest.
This is all symbolism.
Yeah. Yeah. Alma.
And at the end, it's a cycle. And you will go back to the bottom. Pants.
Perhaps there is a cycle. Perhaps there is. Mm-hmm. Perhaps there's an oscillation.
Go back down. Go, you know, return. You are not high here and flying. At the end, you go back again to earth. Mm-hmm. And it's continuously.
So now let's read the sentence that says what Alma just said. Therefore. The sentence begins, therefore. Therefore, before the making of the robe,
here.
The me'il, was mentioned. In other words, and the robe is in the first list of garments. Therefore, before the making of the robe was mentioned, it was not possible to mention the making of the tzitzit. You couldn't mention the tzitzit in the first list. For the great profusion of empowerment that's symbolized by the tzitzit could, God forbid, bring forth an irreverent spirit. A reverent spirit. In other words, if you begin your spiritual life with a sense of being imbued in God, and God is in you and you're in God, if you just begin there with the empowerment and the vitality and the creativity that engenders, it's spiritually dangerous. Because then, of course, you might think you're God. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
You're empowered to make whatever decisions come into your mind. That's not the way. It has to begin with a sense of servitude and obedience, and only move later to the sense of self-empowerment so that you'll have that balance. Therefore, after the making of the me'il and the other 6 garments at the beginning, which teaches the fear was mentioned, it's then possible to mention the making of the tzitzit. And then at the end, he brings in that mystical statement from the Zohar that he mentioned earlier and didn't explain. As in the words of the Holy Zohar, at the time of Mincha of Shabbat, which is after great fear, the brilliance of his desire is revealed, meaning great empowerment. And so that means the following. That statement from the Zohar had talked about the brilliance of the forehead, which is the tzitz, being revealed Shabbat afternoon. Shabbat afternoon is the end of Shabbat. Shabbat symbolizes a day of spiritual enlightenment. And the idea is that the enlightenment symbolized by the tzitz, which is again is the empowerment, the immanence, the sense of God within me, cannot come at the beginning of Shabbat, only at the end. Only after I go through stages of progression. And let me just point out that every day of the week, the three prayer services, Shacharit, Mincha, and Ma'ariv, all have the same Amidah, the same silent prayer, the same Shemona Esrei. On Shabbat, the three prayer services are different. And they each have a different symbolism. The third prayer service on Shabbat, right, it begins with Ma'ariv in the nighttime, Friday night, then Shabbat morning is Shacharit, and then Shabbat afternoon is Mincha. In the Mincha service, the theme of the Shemona Esrei is unity. And we say, God is one, and your people is one. For the mystics, that implies that God and the Jewish people become one. That's, again, the same idea. Mincha is a time of unity with God. And unity means love and joy and empowerment and creativity and life. Okay? We have two more sources to see that make the same point. And I'm debating now. And I think that the second source, we're not going to look inside. There's not a lot of time. I'm going to tell you outside what it says. And then we'll see the third source inside. The second source is about the incense altar in the tabernacle. And the Meir Shiloach relates to an issue that bothered many, many generations of commentators, which is the following. That in Parshat Truma, last week's Truma, it talked about the building of the Mishkan, the walls and the floor, right, and the courtyard and the vessels, that is to say the furniture. But one piece of furniture was missing. It wasn't mentioned. And it has to wait to be mentioned to the end of this week's Parsha, in the wrong Parsha. And that vessel is the altar of incense. And we ask a question, just like we asked about the tzitz. Why is the tzitz not mentioned in the first list, but only later? Same question, why is the altar of incense not mentioned where it belongs, but only later? And the answer the Meir Shiloach will give, we won't read it, we don't have time, is the same answer he just gave to this. He says that the altar of incense, with the incense moving heaven, we can see the smoke going up, that symbolizes connection between heaven and earth. That symbolizes unity. But you can't have that until the end. That's why the altar of incense isn't mentioned with all the other pieces of furniture, but only at the end, because only after a long process can you reach that stage in which you see the connection, the intertwining, the unity between heaven and earth. So look at that. I summarized the whole page for you in
1 minute.
In 1 minute. And that's on the back of what I give up. The first page looks like this, about the altar of incense. And why did I do that so quickly? Because I want to spend 20 minutes on the last source. The last source is an essay by Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cook, the first chief rabbi of Israel. It's called The Thirst for the Living God.
So this was this past years, like 19...
Rav Cook died in 1930. He was the first chief rabbi of the reconstituted settlement of Land of Israel. And he was clearly influenced by the Meir Shiloach and by other Hasidic writers, and he used the Hasidic insights in order to build a whole philosophy of Zionism, whole philosophy of what's happening to the Jewish people in the 20th century. We've talked a little bit in different classes about Rav Kook. Mm-hmm. He doesn't mention sources, he doesn't cite the Me'ah Shiloach, and he translates all these spiritual ideas into lofty concepts, which is hard to see their foundation, but if you look closely, you can see the foundation. I believe that the essay we're about to read, A Thirst for the Living God, is founded upon everything we read today and last week. So look at this beautiful, beautiful, poetic rendering of the ideas we've been talking about. You ready? Here we go. The spirit cannot find its stability except in a life oriented toward God. Knowledge, feeling, the imagination, and the will, in their inner and outer manifestations, all condition people to center their lives in God. Then will they be able to find their fulfillment, their equitable and satisfying state. If a person should seek for himself less than this exalted state, he will at once become like a ship tossed about at sea. Stormy waves raging in opposite directions will continually rob him of peace. He will be thrown from wave to wave. He will be unable to find himself. If he should be able to immerse himself in some crude and vulgar preoccupation, he may succeed for a time in reducing the perspective of his life, and it will seem to him that he has finally found peace. But it will not take long, and the spirit will break out of its imprisonment, and the maddening agitation will begin to act in all its fury. Now, don't try immediately to understand it. Don't try immediately to connect it to things we've learned. Just, I would say, immerse yourself in the words. It takes a while to see where he's going. But basically, he said that you cannot be satisfied in this world in a deep sense of fulfillment without some type of sense of godliness. And you can find all different types of things that may make you happy for a day or for a week or for a month or for a year, but eventually you'll find them to be empty, and your soul again will feel its longing for something greater. The place where we may find peace is only in God. God, however, transcends the existing world. Look at that word, transcends, right? We recognize that word. Making it impossible for us to grasp any aspect of him in feeling or thought. Now we understand that that's the model on the right. Mm-hmm. Transcendence. You can't grasp God, he's beyond. This makes him, as far as we are concerned, non-existent. Because God is so other, you can't relate. And the spirit cannot find contentment in what does not exist. It is for this reason that wise men who devote themselves to the quest for God are, for the most part, spiritually wary. I'm going to stop for a second. It looks like the author has contradicted himself. The first paragraph said, it's so great to be immersed in God. It's so great to be connected to God. It's so great to center your life in God. It's the only way to find fulfillment. And the second paragraph, he said, it's impossible. And it makes you wary because you never find God. He's so far away. There's a contradiction here between the first paragraph and the second paragraph. Okay?
Is that weary, tired?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because in the second paragraph, he says, you can't find God. He's far and distant and other. And if you try your whole life, you'll just become spiritually weary. I see I'm pronouncing with an accent. Weary.
Weary is suspicious.
You're right.
That's
you're right.
The reason.
Help me say it again. Say it again.
I did not want to call that to your...
Weary.
Weary.
Like, okay.
Yeah.
I even don't know what you say.
It means tired, exhausted. You become exhausted if you're searching for something that cannot be found. And God cannot be found. When the soul aspires to the most luminous light, it cannot be content with that light which shines in the quality of justice and the best of good deeds, or in the measure of truth in the most precise body of knowledge, or in the attribute of beauty in the most exalted of visions. In other words, if you're really searching for God, God is other. You won't find him. And you can't satisfy yourself by getting involved in social action or justice or the Museum of Art. All these things are beautiful, but they won't satisfy your soul. That's what the last sentence just said. It's not beauty that will satisfy you. It's not truth in philosophy. It's not justice in the courthouse. If you're looking for God, you can't find it in this world, and you will become weary and depressed. It then sees the world as trivialized. In other words, when you go according to model on the right, God is other and beyond, then, and you know that God can't be found, and become weary searching for him, then this whole world becomes trivialized, because you say, everything in this world is not God. So what is it? It's nothing. It's meaningless. It's just the material. I'm searching for the beyond, the spiritual, the transcendence, and this world becomes just a place I'm passing through. It loses its importance. It loses its centrality. If I'm only searching for the spiritual that's beyond. It reminds us, right, of some Christian weddings, funerals, which they say, you know, right, the person's going to a better place and this world wasn't so good to begin with. That's trivializing the physical world, says Rav Kook. The soul has become so ascendant, so searching for loftiness, that the entire world, its material, as well as its spiritual manifestations, appears to it as an imprisonment, gripping us in its choking atmosphere. Think of a monk, right, who's searching for the God beyond, and this world becomes meaningless. Doesn't really matter. Or think of Siddhartha, right? The the Buddhist monk, who the whole world loses its meaning because I'm searching for the God beyond, who's not in this world, who's beyond this world. Such men seek what is beyond their reach, God who's transcendence. What in their condition does not appear to exist because God is so far away, it's as if he's not. And to change the non-existent to an existence even beyond the will to entertain. It is for this reason that there is often a weakening of the will as well as of the other life forces among people whose inner disposition is directed towards the quest for God. So Rav Kook at this point, if we stop reading, we'd really be in bad shape, because he says that if you don't center your life on God, you'll always be frustrated. That's the first paragraph. Second paragraph says, if you center your life on God, you'll also be frustrated because you can't find it. Right? So he really, really is setting us up for something. I hope you're with me, right? So what are we going to do? What's the solution? It is necessary to show how one may enter the palace by way of the gate. Where's the gate? The gate is the divine dimension disclosed in the world. Understand what he just did?
Move.
Right. He just moved us from here to here in one sentence. He said, look, you can't have meaning in life unless you're centered in God. That was the first paragraph. The second paragraph was, if you have this model of God, you'll never be able to be centered in God because God is far away. What's the gate to the palace? What's the solution? The solution is to move across the line. I'll read it again. It is necessary to show how one may enter the palace by way of the gate. The gate is the divine dimension disclosed in the world, in all its phenomena of beauty and grandeur, as manifested in every living thing, in every insect, in every blooming plant and flower, in every nation and state, in the sea with its turbulent waves, in the panorama of the skies, in the talents of all creatures, in the thoughts of writers, the imagination of poets, and the ideas of thinkers, in the feelings of every sensitive spirit, and in the heroic deeds of every person of valor. In other words, if you have this model on the right of transcendence, well, you'll never find God. because you can't get there. It's too far. It's too beyond. And you look at the world and say, oh, the world has great beauty in it, but it's not God, so I'm not looking for that. The world has justice in it, but that's not God. I'm not looking for it. The world has tremendous power in it, but I'm not looking for that because I'm looking for the beyond. And I gradually lose my sense of empowerment. I lose my sense of connection to the world. The world is trivialized, and I become spiritually weary because I cannot find what I'm looking for. Rav Kook says the gate to the palace is to switch your consciousness to go from transcendence to immanence, and to understand that the justice in the world is God's justice, and the beauty in the world, it's God's beauty. And the deep ideas and insights, they're God's insights. They're no longer separate from God, and therefore no longer trivialized, when you realize it's all part of one organic whole, which is the model of immanence. The highest domain of divinity towards which we aspire, to be absorbed in it, to be included in, it's right, absorbed in, it's all in, it's inside, but which eludes all our longing, descends for us into the world, right? It's not beyond, it's in. And we encounter it and delight in its love and find peace in its tranquility. At times, moreover, we are privileged with a flash emanating from the higher radiance, from that higher light which transcends all thought. The heavens open for us when we see a vision of God. In other words, when you're in the immanent model and you're here in the world, well, in the world you see God. And sometimes you even see outside to God because you have that connection. You see these flashes of lightning. Since you see God in the world, you can also sometimes see flashes of God that's even beyond that, but that can only be experienced if you're in the model of immanence and not if you're stuck in the model of transcendence, claims Rav Kook. But we know that this is only a temporary state of the flashes of lightning. The flash will pass and we will descend to dwell once again, not inside the palace, but only in the courts of the Lord. But we're in the courts of the Lord. We're not separate. When the longing for the light reaches its highest point, it begins to draw a great profusion of light from the hidden radiance in our own soul, through which is revealed the great truth, that all the worlds with all that is in them only appear to us particular effulgences, but they're in truth manifestations of the higher light. Let me explain that. The word particular here is a philosophical use of the word you might not recognize. Particular means separate. That is, we see things as separate flashes. But they're not. They're in truth manifestations of the higher light. They're part of one phenomena. And seen in their essence, they make up one whole. A unitary manifestation in which is included all beauty, all light, all truth, and all good. It's all one, because it's all within God, claims Rav Kook. These manifestations continually emerge and develop. They show themselves increasingly as in truth individual expressions of the all good. They're individual expressions, but they're part, everything is part of one. The bounty that streams through all good, that raises the soul to its highest, that on the one hand shrinks for us the significance of the existential world, the physical as well as the spiritual in all its splendor and magnificence, this very bounty now renews for us all the worlds and all creatures, endowing them with a new image, and every sign of life stirs joy. And every good deed delights the heart, and every discipline of study broadens the mind. I have to read that again to explain it. Let's analyze that sentence. It's a long sentence. It begins with the bounty. Right, so it begins with the bounty. The bounty that streams through all the good, that's the godly rays that is in everything, that raises the soul to its highest, that on the one hand shrinks for us the significance of the existential world. In other words, he's saying here on the one, it means if you went back to the transcendent model, then the fact that there's a great God, that shrinks the significance of this world. But that's only when you go back to the wrong model. That's on the one hand, as he's summing up here. So on the one hand, shrinks for us, it contracts the significance of the existential world. That's when you, what he said earlier, that's when you, what expression did he use there? Use the expression, that trivialization of the world. That's when you're in the transcendent model. This very bounty, in other words, the fact that God is God, now renews for us all the worlds and all creations. Renews in the sense of all the world is not trivialized by God, it's rather imbued with meaning by God, if you understand correctly, that God is part of it all, and it's all part of God. This very bounty now renews for us all the worlds and all creatures, endowing them with a new image, and every sign of life stirs joy, and every good deed delights the heart, and every discipline of study broadens the mind. It's all part of discovering God within the world, not outside the world, within the world. The narrow boundaries of all these no longer press the soul, because it's no longer narrow. There are no boundaries anymore. Which at once realizes that all these tiny sparks continually ascend and become integrated into the comprehensive unity of all life.
So it's a model that intertwine both of them at the same time. You are one part sometimes in the left model and sometimes in the right model, and you are just continuing moving.
I'm not sure that you're right. Based on Rav Kook, there's a clear preference for one over the other. Right?
Yeah, but at the beginning...
Right, you're right. It begins here, but it's moving here.
Yeah.
And we don't really see a movement backwards.
At the first part of what he was saying, he was talking about the left side.
No, in the first paragraph, he's just saying that in general, without committing himself to different models, the first paragraph is just saying that if life is not centered in God, there's no meaning. The second paragraph says, but it's impossible to be centered in God because God is so far away. And then he says the answer is to move from this model to this model.
Yeah.
So I hope that it's meaningful. I hope you see how it's based upon the earlier sources in the Me'a Shiloach and in the Kedushat HaLevi and in the Beis Yaakov. And Rav Kook really translates it into a meaningful and beautiful idiom that could just make some sense. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much. It's very, very...